And I'm happy to introduce your main speaker tonight, Marissa May from Orchard, California.
Yes. And I go 45 minutes until 8 o'clock?
Yeah.
Until the end, okay. Hi everyone, my name is Marissa May and I am an alcoholic. It's really good to be here with you all back in the 1600 Club. Thank you for my compadre Raul for inviting me to speak today and asking me to be of service to this program that has given me so much. And especially this room, it's really nice to be speaking again at the 1600 Club. It was actually in this room that I admitted from this podium that at 7 years that I had not yet done the steps. And from that speaking, the journey really began in sobriety. Up until that point, I was not drinking. You know, I was definitely away from the substance, away from alcohol, away from mind and mood altering substances. But I really didn't know what was on offer here. All I knew is that I could put down the drink. That's what I knew. So it took 7 years in the program for me to even be willing to do the steps. So that's my journey. My sobriety date is 7/16/2014. So I did just celebrate 12 years, and that, you know, it's been a wild ride. I do want to start because I remember when I first walked into this club, I saw this quote up here, and I am definitely a page 44 alcoholic. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. And I did both of those things. When I honestly wanted to, I couldn't quit entirely. I could quit a little bit. I could quit with the end goal, you know, but I couldn't quit entirely. When I was drinking, I didn't know how much I would drink that night. There were some nights where I could drink a little bit. You know, I could say, I don't have anywhere to be tomorrow. And I would just, you know, drink a few and go home with somebody and be fine, you know. Or I drank to oblivion and blacked out and didn't know where I was going. But I didn't know which. You know, I was not in control of my drinking once that drink hit my lips. So I started drinking when I was 18, but I was definitely doing alcoholic things before that. I was restless, irritable, and discontent as a child, but I really judged people who drank and used drugs to cope. That was like the cool kids in high school, and I was like, I'm not like them, you know? And instead, what I tapped into was athletics and academic performance. I needed to get my power, property, and prestige from my performance in those things. So I was a varsity athlete. I didn't want to sacrifice, you know, even 1/10 of a second in my track running. And so I didn't drink. I didn't party. And I also, like, was, you know, in AP classes, and I was really, really motivated to see what would happen after high school. But at the same time, I was a liar, a cheat, and a thief. You know, my parents would think I was having a sleepover with my friends and I was over at my boyfriend's house, you know, or my parents would think that I was at the mall and I was cutting up over here with my friends, you know, like I was not ever doing what I said that I would be doing. And I was living like a double life. And I heard in a meeting the other day, I'm a high bottom drunk, which means I was just successful at living multiple lives. And that's really what I was doing as a young child. You know, I was like a successful student, but in the dark, in the shadows, you know, I was doing other things and breaking rules and, you know, thinking I was getting away with it. But, you know, I didn't get in trouble from any external place, but my spirit was disturbed. You know, my soul was darkened because of that. I was always having to look over my shoulder, and my sister and I, we would have like a plan B and then a plan C if the B failed, you know, and like really A is what we were telling our parents was going on, you know, so we had all these contingency plans. And, you know, and when I made amends to my sister, I said, you know, I really wasn't a good older sister because I was bringing you along in that. You know, I have a responsibility as an older sibling in my Filipino culture to be the one who teaches respect, to be the one who is a good role model. And I was not doing those things, you know, and I wasn't. I was really showing her the way of the world that was not the way. And that was a really, really interesting time because I was I didn't have the words at the time, but now I know after doing step work that I was really living in justification, rationalization. I was thinking that since I was making good grades and I was showing up for track, that I could do whatever I wanted. I felt like I deserved to be bad, you know, because I was taking care of what society said my job was. And that is a through line of thinking that continues to this day. That is a main character defect of mine that, you know, if I'm doing what you need me to do, that I can be in the shadows doing whatever I want to do. And so a lot of my step work and my work today is about merging, you know, stepping into the light and staying there, not trying to go back into the shadows, because that's where I want to be. Because ultimately, I believe that I am dark. I want to live in the dark and twisted side of my nature, you know, like it says in our book. I don't want to be in the sunlight of the spirit. When I am left to my own devices, that's not where I live. So my childhood was actually really good. You know, my parents were very loving. They raised us in a really stable home, but, you know, with means, but didn't spoil us. But, you know, to give a little bit of a picture, my mom is Asian and my dad is a Vietnam vet. So it was a lot of structure, order, and discipline that I had in my life. There were expectations of behavior, expectations of care, expectations of responsibility, and family honor. Those were all really important to our family. And I really resented that. I really did not like that. My parents had us living a certain way, would tell us that things had to be a certain way, suit up, show up, go here, do this, no questions asked, which when I got to AA sounded very familiar. You know, I was like, this is what I have been missing. But I was so resentful of that. I rebelled against that so much. I rebelled against it into my teens. And when I had an opportunity to attend college, I knew that I wanted to be as far away as possible from my family because I had just resented so much my childhood of being told what to do and feeling like I was being put into a box, which now, after doing my step work, it's like my parents were doing the best they could and they raised us well. There are so many benefits I have from my childhood to this day, but at the time I didn't see it. You know, at the time I didn't want to see it. I wanted to see it in the way that I wanted to see it. The other added wrinkle from my childhood is that my father was raised by an alcoholic. So my grandfather was a raging alcoholic, and I can say that because he identified as an alcoholic. He came into the rooms of AA for many years, but never had long-term sobriety. So he took many one-year cakes, and a lot of the time that he was in AA, it was either ordered by the military or ordered by his wife, you know, if you don't get into AA, if you don't get sober, I'm going to leave. Or if you don't get sober, if you don't get in AA and get your act together, you're going to be dishonorably discharged, you know? So a lot of my dad's childhood was watching an alcoholic wreak havoc on the family. He had 5 siblings, and thinking that AA doesn't work. So he would tell stories about my grandfather, and I would identify with my grandfather's behavior when I was young, when I was in my teens, when I was young, and I would think like, man, you know, Grandpa Buck doesn't seem too bad. You know, he doesn't seem like that bad of a dude. It just seems like he was making some poor choices. But my father and his siblings were clearly affected. And so I didn't really understand that. I didn't understand what that meant. But what I knew was that being an alcoholic, according to that family, was the worst thing that you could be. It meant that you didn't deserve a family. It meant that you were, should be stepped on the ground. And what my dad would say things was like, my dad wasn't a man. My grandfather wasn't a man. He would say, you know, he wasn't a man because he was an alcoholic and he didn't take care of his family. So to me, being an alcoholic was the bottom dregs of society. You know, that is the worst that you could be. But then I started identifying with my grandfather, and then I wondered, oh no, if I'm like that, if I'm an alcoholic, what does that mean? Because it seems like there's no solution then. Because I'm also being told that AA doesn't work. I'm also being told that there's no hope for somebody who is an alcoholic and that they'll just die an alcoholic death like my grandfather was relegated to. So this was all going on up until I was 18, and then went away to college as far away as I could possibly go from my parents, which also meant I was going to a college where I didn't know anybody, and it was in the Midwest, and I have grown up in California my whole life. In California, you know, it's very diverse. There's a lot of different perspectives. There's a lot of different kinds of people. And then I went to the Midwest, and it was nothing like that. At my college, it was nothing like that. And I had no tools. I was already so wrapped up in myself, and I didn't have any of the tools that I had leaned on of varsity athletics. I was burnt out in athletics, so I chose not to pursue it in college. My academic rigor was not something I could tap into anymore, because I went to a college where everybody had been that kind of top of the academic scale in their high schools, and then everyone was there. So I didn't have an identity as being like the smart one anymore, because everybody was, you know. And I was from California. I didn't understand, you know, the mores and the society that I was experiencing in this college. And I was just, I'm meeting new people, and the first week of school, it was freshman orientation, and I was in this dorm, and like everybody gets together, and then you go and like sing songs, and you have to like do skits and be vulnerable, and I was just like, I don't want any of this. No, I cannot do it. I had no tools. I was not equipped to walk through that at all. And after the first week of school, that was freshman orientation. Then the seniors, there was this like underground party, you know, grapevine rumor mill. And they were like, after orientation, we have a party called Disorientation. And it's a party in a place, it's like Rally in the Alley, you know, and it's just a party, you know, with a lot of drinking. And everyone was like, oh, I'm going to that. And I was like, okay, I guess that's what we do. You know, we just, you know, follow whatever. So all the seniors were like, you got to come to this. So I remember being at this party, and I'm just thinking, where am I? You know, because I hadn't drank in high school, so I had no frame of reference as to what to do at a party. You know, I was in like the nerdy crowd. You know, our parties were like, let's go study and have snacks. You know, that's what we did. You know, so I really didn't know what was going on, and I was just looking around and seeing people drinking and talking and laughing and loud and music and. And was like, I probably looked just like this, like with a frown, like what's going on? And somebody handed me a beer. I was just like, drink this. And I'm like, I'm sure it was like Natty Light, you know, like something just, you know, not for taste, you know. And put it in my hand, and I remember drinking it and just immediately feeling this like wash over me of like, oof, okay, yes. About a month before that, I had had a similar feeling, because my grandfather had passed away, and my cousins knew that I was going away to college, so they asked my parents, can we get Marissa drunk for the first time so that she's not doing it at school for the first time? And my dad was like, you know, sure. So it was a wake, you know, and in my culture, the wakes are very fun, and, you know, a funeral is a celebration of life, and so everyone was drinking. That was not abnormal. So they gave me my drink, and immediately what I wanted to do was be away from everybody. So in my aunt's house where we were, there was a basement, and there were beanbag chairs and lights, and I just drank, I don't even know what it was, maybe like tequila and orange juice or something is what they had given me. And I was just drinking, sitting there, and the room was spinning, and it was calm and quiet, and I just felt warm and safe. And that is what I connected alcohol to from that point forward. It was warm, it was safe. It gave me a little bit of a distance between me and whatever was going on out there. And that was also the first night that I judged somebody for drinking too much, because my cousin got too drunk and was throwing up off of the porch. And I just thought, ugh, like, she can't handle her liquor. This is the first night I've ever drank, you know, and I am judging how other people can or cannot hold their liquor, you know. So flash forward, I'm at the party, everything's calm, and then I realized, oh yeah, that's the feeling. That's the feeling that alcohol gives me. I'm experiencing it again. And then once I was relaxed, I started to be able to be part of the party. I wasn't just watching and looking. I was able to approach people and talk to people and be approached and accept, you know, conversation and dancing, conviviality and joy. And then from that point forward, that's all I ever used as a tool to connect with other people and my peers in society. From that point forward, until the day that I stopped drinking, that was always a common thread through all of my interactions. To have alcohol and substances to create that distance between me and you, because true vulnerability was too difficult for me to handle. And I didn't want to develop any other tools. Alcohol worked. And so that started, and after a month into school, I got in trouble. I broke a rule that is very unique to my school, that were related to where you can and cannot be after a certain hour of the evening, and I was drunk while I was doing it. And so as a result of that punishment, I was sentenced to 200 hours of community service and alcohol counseling. And so what that was at my college was meeting with our Office of Drug and Alcohol support, and one of the counselors there, his name is Kelly. I have not yet been able to locate this person, so if anyone's listening to this recording and you know someone named Kelly who worked at a university in the Midwest in the drug and alcohol counseling department, let me know. So he would meet with me and we would talk about how to control and enjoy my drinking. It would be like, what are you doing this weekend? What's the plan? I'm gonna go to this party. Okay, so this time, why don't you pull tabs off the beer until you've hit five and then just stop drinking. Put it in your pocket, take five and stop drinking. Okay, next week rolls around, how'd it go? Well, Kelly, I pulled tabs until I got to five, and then I just kept going until I got to 10, you know, and then went home. And so it was like, okay, next week, the strategy, he would say, he asked me, would you ever drink? Because I did like to drink drinks mixed with juice. And so he was like, well, would you ever drink 8 16-ounce glasses of cranberry juice just like in an evening? And I was like, no. And then he said, well, then why do you drink that much liquid when it's vodka and cranberry? And I said, because there's vodka in it. Kelly, like, that is, it's not a one-to-one. I cannot do that. And so he was so, the entire treatment plan was really about how to limit my drinking, to still have fun, and really bless his heart. I never admitted that I had a problem. You know, it was like I was a freshman, it was a one-off problem, and it was never, I was like, oh, I'm a freshman, I'm in college, this is what we're supposed to do, we're supposed to drink. And so I did my 8 sessions. At the end, he actually cleared me to be a role model in group therapy of other alcoholics who were going through this situation, through this punishment. And they had been sentenced to group, and I was supposed to be the role model group member. And when I think about it now, it was very close to AA. You know, it was people sharing about their drinking experience and meaning to identify with each other. But what I saw were people that were way worse than I was. Like, you know, people with high blood alcohol content levels or had passed out because they went drunk to a final. These were the things that I was hearing. And I was like, well, I'm not that. You know, so by the age of 19, I didn't know it. I don't really share about this often. I wasn't in the rooms of AA, but I was in the rooms of fellowship with other alcoholics who were sharing their story, and I did not identify. I was looking for the differences and not the similarities, and I was positioning myself as better than my fellows so that I didn't have to look at myself. So flash forward, I go to graduate school. I'm, you know, in my mid-20s, and by that time, again, remember from the beginning of my story, if I'm doing what you need me to do, I can do whatever I want here in the shadows. So I was doing service projects and you know, but I did a service project, but I chose the location of New Orleans so that when I was off, when I, you know, I had time off, I would just go hang out in the French Quarter and get plastered, you know. But I could show up for the kids, you know, in the group home from the hours of 9 to 5, you know, and then I could go and do whatever. Then I got in trouble there. I lost a key. They had to rekey the whole house because I lost a key on Bourbon Street, you know, and like, there's all these things that happened as a result of my drinking, but I could never see it for myself. I could never see that there was a correlation between those things happening and the alcohol drinking. So that was going on, mid-20s, graduate school. So I started my graduate program on a full ride scholarship. And all I needed to do to keep it was to study and stay in the top percentage of my class and, you know, be an upstanding student, which I knew how to do, right? I knew how to do that from my high school years. I know I have the skills to do that, but, you know, the intervening factor of alcohol and partying was definitely there. And so what I convinced myself was is that I didn't want to keep a full ride scholarship. You know, I didn't need to let the school take care of my finances. I could just do whatever I wanted, and I would be able to survive the rest of the years without it. And so I chose not to study. And by the time that I graduated, I did graduate by the skin of my teeth, and out of a class of like 102, I was maybe 97, you know, on the list. I had no attempt to really try and excel in that program at all. And my many amends that I did were to professors that I had at that time, some of which had already died, which was really painful for me because those professors, I had held them in such high esteem when I was there. I knew that internally, but my actions did not match it. You know, how I showed up in class, how I showed up to office hours, what I did with the information that they were pouring into me, they did not experience a person who respected them. Okay, that's what I was living in my fantasy land world in my head. So I was not a contributing member to that community. You know, I was really just trying to get by, and in a lot of toxicity in a relationship, just so much negative was happening. And yet still, I could not correlate that negativity was as a result of my drinking and selfish and self-centered nature that was manifesting in my party lifestyle. So I go and I get a job, and you know, I've taken the bar 4 times, have never passed, you know, the surprise, you know, because I basically learned nothing in school. And I'm just trying to fit a square peg in a round hole, you know, like I want what I want. I've done what you need me to do. Why am I not getting what I want? And this whole time, I have what I perceive as a good relationship with my higher power, because I grew up in a faith tradition that had me really close to my faith community. I was, again, doing things in the light. I was of service. I was mentoring youth. I was, you know, going to weekly religious practice. I was volunteering. And I thought that since I was doing all the actions, that I had a good relationship with my higher power. I was even doing the rituals that are very similar to our 12 steps. You know, taking inventory and going to confess to somebody of what was going on. So I was doing all the actions, and I thought that gave me a ticket to my higher power, and I was connected. But I was very, very far. Now I know I was very, very far from my higher power. I was acting as if, but not experiencing the connection to my higher power, and definitely not inviting, I call my higher power God, definitely not inviting God into the mix ever. You know, I was not doing that. So I'm at kind of the end of my drinking career. I'm in my late mid to late 20s, and I'm at a job that I hate a lot, you know, a boss that I just find really reprehensible and with poor morals, which it's like, I think to this day, like I was the one judging, like, oh, you have poor morals and you don't have integrity, you know, and you don't know how to act in the light, you know, and here am I doing what I'm doing. And I didn't know at the time, if I see it in you, I probably have it in me. And so I was just hating that whole experience. And about 6 months before that, I had met somebody who was in the program of AA. And that was a huge drama in our family because, as you remember, in my family, being an alcoholic is the worst thing that you can be. And so when they found out that my partner was an alcoholic, it didn't matter that he was in AA, because remember, AA doesn't work. So it was a really big deal. And there was a lot of, in my family, you know, their judge and jury, there was a lot of decisions from the aunts and uncles if, you know, this person was okay to date Marissa. Little did they know that I had the problem myself, you know, because I had never admitted that to my family, and I hid a lot from my family as, you know, plans A, B, and C, you know, so that they don't really see how I am. And so, but what I saw in my partner, who's in the program, and some of you know him, was that he was able to meet calamity with serenity every time. And I did not understand that. And he would say things like, well, we just have to let go and let God. And I would be like, what do you mean? Like, we can't, what do you mean let go and let God? I was just like, he would go low and I would go way crazy, you know, up here, aggressive, you know, and I would push buttons and I was just like, no, you know, and what I knew what to do was fight. Like, connection in my family was confrontation, not always fighting and yelling, but it was debate. It was confrontation, it was discussion. That's what happened in my family. And so when he would not engage in that, like, oh, I'm not interested in that conflict, okay. I had a lot of concern and fear around that. Because if I only know how to connect through that, then I can't do, I don't know how to be in a relationship with you. And so I would pick fights a lot, you know, and he would not, you know, pick up the rope. And so I was just spinning all the time like a Tasmanian devil. And so, but what I had was alcohol still as a tool. And even though he was sober, his family and his friends were not. So when I would go to family reunions or family outings or friendship things or meeting his professors, I could always be drinking. And so that was my tool to connect with his family. So I would be drinking with the aunts and uncles, drinking with the cousins, doing all this, and that's what I knew how to do, but I wasn't really ever connecting with them. And there were many times where I would drink and get too drunk and to be too hungover to go to the soccer game the next day of the little nieces and nephews, or too inebriated to really engage in any kind of conversation or remember what I had learned about the people that I was connecting with. So I really wasn't, you know, again, no tools. So there was the what brought me into the room was that job I hated. I had quit in a fit of rage, and I told my boss, I can't work for you anymore. I'm not going to work for you. And he was like, why don't you take just like a 2-week sabbatical and just chill and then come back and we'll talk about it. Like, I don't know, to this day, I don't know if he knew, you know, what was going on with me, but he did not want me to quit. Or he, you know, so he just let me take like a leave. And I was on that leave and I was just drinking every day. I was supposed to be thinking about, you know, what I wanted to do with my life, and I just was not taking the time to do that. And we went down, it was July. I quit right before July 4th, and then I came in, you know, my sobriety date of July 16th. So we had our big soiree, July 4th, and to this day, July 4th is still my favorite holiday because that was my last drinking holiday ever. So I think about it, it's like every year I just like, you know, remember the time. But it wasn't even really a good time. It was just, it was the last holiday. And I was with my brother-in-law and my niece and drinking with them. And my niece was at the time 7 or 6 even. Yeah, 7 or 8. Anyway, she was young. And so she wanted to like hang out with me, right? And so I'm under the influence and she wants me to read her a story. And so I'm in her bed and she says like, we were reading a story about like pancakes or waffles or breakfast or something. And I said, have you ever had waffles before? And she said, no, I've never had them, but we have a maker. And I said, okay, tomorrow morning I'll make you waffles. And as we were reading, I passed out in her bed. And, you know, at the time I was like, oh, I just fell asleep, you know, with my niece. But no, I passed out and she was there and she fell asleep. And in the morning I was really hurting. I woke up, she wasn't yet awake. And I remember just thinking, looking over at her face and just having this deep feeling of resentment and rage because of her, now I have to get out of this bed even though I'm feeling rough and make some waffles. You know, like I was already blaming that it was her fault that I had to do this. And so I started to get up and get ready. I'm making the waffles and I'm just nauseous. I can't do it. So I pour one waffle. My husband, my partner comes down. And I'm like, you have to finish this. I can't do this. You know, this girl needs waffles. And so he finishes. I go upstairs, start throwing up, taking care of my hangover. And I can hear my niece and my sister-in-law, my brother-in-law, and my partner, like, laughing. You know, I can hear them having a great time. And I just think, again, it happened again where
I used alcohol as a connection and it just got away from me. And here I am now not doing the thing that I really want to do. You know, I knew that I wanted to be in his family to marry him. And I was just like, I'm going to lose this opportunity if I don't get it together, you know? And so I'm in the bed and I hear a knock on the door and my niece says through the door, Auntie Marissa, can you play the game of life with me? And it was just that moment of clarity. No, like I cannot play the game of life if I am going this way, you know? And I didn't get sober that day, but I don't think I drank after that because I was just like not, I don't know. Maybe I did. I don't really remember. But the morning of the 16th, when I woke up, I turned to my fiance and I said, I'm pretty sure I have a problem with alcohol and I need to stop drinking for good. And like a real good AA, when the hand of AA was there, or when the hand was asked and the hand was there, and he said, well, we lived in Torrance at the time, I know there's a meeting today at the Torrance Solano Club and I can take you. You know, he was just totally ready. And the gift that he gave me is that at my first meeting, he did not go with me. He dropped me off. And my first meeting was a biker meeting at that club. And it was just the meeting that I could go to that was the next meeting that was available. So I went to it and I roll up, you know, he drops me off and there's all these Harleys lined up, you know, everybody's wearing their leathers. It is a biker meeting. Like there is nobody there that is not aware that this is a biker meeting and they probably are going to go ride after, you know, and I'm rolling up. Not in leathers, clearly not a biker. And I sit in the corner and they were not, you know, people you hear when they first come in, they go to meetings that are really like warm and welcoming, like, oh, hello, so good to see you, we're so glad you're here. No, that was not the experience I had. And they just kind of looked at me like, why are you here? But because clearly it's a biker meeting, you know? But I didn't resent that at all. I was so relieved that nobody was talking to me. Like, I was so relieved that they just watched me come in, let me slink in and sit in the corner, and I just watched them. And what I watched were these hardcore people who, because I really venerated the culture, gang culture and motorcycle culture, and I studied sociology, so that whole concept of, like, a camaraderie around a central, potentially dangerous, you know, goal was really fascinating to me, and I really enjoyed being around it or whatever. So I watched this, and these were these hardcore people who I knew were like, I'm just, excuse my language, but like this badasses, you know, I knew that. And I was like, okay, but all of them are sober. Like that I needed to see that. I needed to see that coming to AAA didn't mean that I would have to become a goody two shoes, because I didn't think that was possible. I didn't think it was possible for me to be like that. That I wouldn't have to give up fun, because I thought that I would have to give up fun. So I saw these bikers who were ribbing each other. They were having a good time. They were calling each other nicknames, and you know, they were laughing. And then they had a great meeting. I don't remember what was shared at all. But I remember people would share and other people would nod and laugh. And so what I walked away from that meeting was, you can still have a life when you are sober if you give up alcohol. And a lot of them also talked about drugs. So if you give up all the substances, all the alcohol, you can still have a great time. You can still be connected with people. And remember, I didn't have any tools other than alcohol to connect with people. And what I saw in that meeting was 100% connection. So I knew that you all had something that I needed, because I did not know how to connect to other people. So I got sober in that club, but we moved away like 2 weeks after that. So I really, my first time into AA was in Ventura. But there was about 2 months before I came in as myself, identifying as an alcoholic, where I would sit with my boyfriend in meetings and just listen. Because I was like supporting him, you know, I'm an ally to the sober community, you know, that's what I would say. And I would sit there, you know, and he got sober in a group called the Trudgers down in Southern California. And they were very serious, you know, and they would talk about their drinking and they were very structured. And I was like, man, you know, that's okay. So I would listen to those kinds of things. And they were an offshoot of the Pacific Group, which was also very structured. And I heard about this, you know, the Pacific Group. You have to wear a tie and you have to wear a dress and you have to suit up and show up, you know, in Malibu. And I was like, oh, I could never do that, you know. And now today, my sponsor and my grand sponsor got sober in the Pacific Group. So, you know, I think that the higher power brings us back around to what we really need. So I knew about AA. I'd been hearing about AA, and then I identified. So I went to Ventura, and I got a sponsor because I knew that that's what you needed to do, you know, get a sponsor. And but I didn't know what that meant to really get a sponsor. I just knew the words. And so this woman came up to me in a meeting, like my second meeting in Ventura, and she gave me a business card. And it had her name on it. And it didn't matter that it was a business card of what she did. It was just the fact that she had a business card, you know, that she worked for herself and she had this card that she could give me. And I thought, wow, this lady's got it going on, you know. So I asked her to be my sponsor. And I was very defiant. You know, I was like, oh, you know, I don't need the 12 steps because, you know, the religion that I'm part of, we do all of that. And so, like, I'm already at step 12, you know. And she was like, okay. She said, well, I think that we should do something together. I mean, if we're working together, I have to bring you through some sort of program, you know, the steps. And she knew about something called the Artist's Way, which in LA was kind of like a big, it's a 12-step inspired creative journey. And so we used that book together for the beginning. And the central thing of that is that you do these morning pages, like journaling brain dumps. And it's not AA. You know, I'm not saying that I don't endorse that. But that is what I could manage. That's what I could muster. You know, the disciplined program of AA was too much for me. I could not even approach that. And my sponsor, really, bless her, she was like, I'm not gonna fight, you know, she didn't say this, but I know now, I'm sure she was thinking, like, I'm not gonna fight you. Like, if you don't wanna do the book, I'm not gonna force it, and whatever, I'll just, whatever, we'll do what you are able to do. So we did that. I got to the fourth step, and she was like, all right, we're gonna do some inventory. And I wrote one inventory on one person, and I was like, okay, here's my fourth step. And I truly, at that time, believed that was the only harm I had done. With this one ex, you know, that one relationship, one ex. And so I read the whole thing to her, and I wrote pages and pages and pages about this relationship. And then I read it to her, and she was like, okay, well, that's a start, but like, I think you should, let's explore more. And I said, no, I'm not gonna do that. And then I didn't, you know, and then the Thomas fire happened, and I had a baby, and we basically fell out. She was still my sponsor in name, but I didn't call her. I didn't connect with her at all. We didn't do step work. And that was in 2019. And then COVID happened. And so when COVID happened, I was 3 years sober, 3.5 years. And I, like everyone else, you know, really didn't know what was going to happen in recovery. But also, I'm an educator, and I was not going to do one more second on Zoom when I got off the clock. So I was not at all interested in Zoom meetings. So I went to none. You know, I went to no Zoom meetings during the time of COVID until we moved here to Santa Maria in 2022 or something when we moved here. And so I was going crazy during COVID. But the best that I could do, what I did do is listen to speaker tapes and the big book on tape or on audiobook online when I would go on really long walks. So I had the vocabulary of AA, the message, experience, strength, and hope of others, and my husband and his program. I rode his coattails for a long time. I had all of that during COVID. So I was immersed in the program, but I wasn't doing individual step work. So when I moved here, what I remember is when the meetings opened in Ventura, they allowed us that we could be in meetings outside with masks, but we could gather. I remember when that restriction was lifted. And I told my husband, I really wanna go to one of those meetings. I need a meeting. And he said, I don't want to go to that. And it was the first time ever that I was very angry that I couldn't go to a meeting. Because up until that point, I didn't really care about meetings. I was plugging into work, up to my old tricks. I would go to meetings infrequently. But I was like, no, I know I need a meeting. And I was mad that, and I could have gone by myself, you know, but I was mad that he didn't want to go with me. And so that changed something in me. Like, oh, okay, I something is changing in my spirit and in my sobriety, because now I'm seeking connection to my fellow alcoholics. I'm seeking gathering and being in a meeting because I've been away from it for so long. So when we moved here, we moved to Orchid, and we were basically doing like a 90 and 90, you know, like let's hit up as many meetings as we can. Let's meet the fellowship. Let's see who's here. And I was going, our very first meeting was was Lion's Den. And it was just immediate warmth. It was like, okay, this is the fellowship here in Orchid. Central Coast AA, I think, is truly special. And so we got connected and plugged in. And I became a GSR because that meeting was announcing for like, I don't know, 10 weeks. Like, we need a GSR. And I was getting so annoyed. I was like, God, can't somebody stand up and be the GSR? Like, I don't want to hear this announcement anymore. And then I thought, well, I guess I need to be, you know, of course, I need to be the hero in every situation. So I became a GSR. I was doing service. I became a secretary. You know, I was secretary of meetings. I was being of service. And I was just sitting in rooms hating my life. Like, everyone was happy, joyous, and free. And I was just like, ugh, you know, what's the point of being sober? Because I hate my life right now, you know? My life was good, but I just was like squirrely. You know, I didn't know how close I was to a drink, but I wasn't happy in my spirit. And I was doing the coffee commitment at the monthly speaker meeting in Orchid. And if you have had that commitment, everyone has an opinion about the sweetness of the lemonade, about how dark it is or light it is, about why we have this iced tea and not green tea iced tea. And the coffee has to be to their liking, you know? And so I was not loving my life in that commitment at all. And I was resenting my husband because he had signed us up for that commitment and then his work schedule changed and he was never there. So I had to do it all by myself. And so I was just like, God, AA is just really cramping my style. And then a woman came and spoke at that meeting. And everything she said were things that I had kept inside that I had never said out loud. And it was like a fire hose of information, and I knew I wanted more. And so I asked her to be my sponsor. And I went, I'm gonna say this because I say this as much as possible. Leo gave me advice, a suggestion once. If you go to a speaker meeting, go up and shake the hand of the speaker because they gave us their time and the least you can do is say thank you. And I heeded that suggestion for whatever reason, 2 months before. So I was in line to say thank you and I felt it bubble up out of me to ask her, will you be my sponsor? Are you taking sponsees? Will you be my sponsor? And she said yes. And we started working the steps. And she was really big on doing the program as outlined in the big book. What a novel idea, you know? And I was very willing to do it because by that time I knew that I would be going out if I didn't change something. So we started doing the steps. And then I moved to Maine. And so I was doing the steps with my sponsor lives in Arizona. I was living in Maine. And, life was very different in Maine from California. And life was good. Very rural, though. And so there was one meeting a day where we lived. And sometimes the meeting that was happening that day was 45 minutes away. So I shifted to doing almost all of my meetings online, which is also ironic to me because I was so unwilling to do Zoom online during COVID when I had to. And then again, I had to when I was living in this rural community. And so we got busy on the steps. It took me a year and a half to do my fourth step because I did nothing for a year. And I said, oh, I had a baby. I can't do that. So I sat on my fourth step for a year and a half. Do not recommend. I was not a happy camper during that time. And everything was painful. My emotions were right at the surface at all times because my character defects were so present to me. But then I had the opportunity to fly out to Arizona and do my fifth step with her, and it was so transformative. We did 5 through 7 in that weekend, and the seventh step, I didn't know it would happen, but I just started weeping when I started saying that seventh step prayer. Because up until that point, I didn't know what have all of me meant. You know, I didn't know what all of me, who all of me was. I didn't know what that was. So I wept and I wept. And that was, that unlocked something in my spirit. And then my eighth step was such a wild ride. I thought there were people that I loved and adored and I had never harmed them. And that was not true. It was a lie. And that was to face myself in the eighth step and then make amends in the ninth step was really transformative. And to this day, I'm still making amends because I was living in Maine. A lot of my harm had been done in California. So I could do a little bit at a time when I would come back for vacation. Now that I'm here, I'm doing more. More consistently my amends and going through the list. And so that's still interesting. And now, like 12 years in, I was part of general service in the Maine area. I had an area level position with the website, and I was secretary, and I was just, you know, giving of myself. And I can't believe that I'm trusted with the things that I'm trusted with, you know, passwords and email passwords and things that, you know, that this person who likes to live in the dark, you know, if I had that before, I would have exploited, you know, and I don't have to do that today. You know, I just get to suit up and show up and be of service. And and we were walking through a lot of drama at the area level. And I just get to be a trusted servant in that space, you know, when things happen, because we're not saints, you know, we're alcoholics and we're making progress, but we are definitely not saints. And today I have a beautiful life. I have four kids. They've never seen me drink. They've never seen their dad drink. And we get to really do amazing stuff. I'm trusted with the lives of other people's children as an educator, and really get to be part, to be brought along in a lot of amazing joy because I'm not wrapped up in myself. You know, I'm so excited to see what's going on with you and to experience joy with you. And to be so happy that you're having a baby, or be so happy that you're graduating, and not have to think about what am I going to get out of it. So I'm grateful for what AA has given me. Thank you for letting me spend some time with you all, and thank you for my sobriety.
All right, let's give Marissa another round of applause.